While Paul was waiting for Silas and Timothy to join them in Athens, he was deeply distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he argued in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons, and also in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Also, some Epicurean and Stoic philosophers debated with him. Some said, "What does this babbler want to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a proclaimer of foreign divinities." This was because he was telling the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. So they took Paul and brought him to the Areopagus and asked him, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? It sounds rather strange to us, so we would like to know what it means." Now the Athenians and the foreigners living there would spend their time in nothing but telling or hearing something new. Then Paul stood up in front of the Areopagus and said, "Athenians, I see how extremely religious you are in every way. For as I went through the city and looked carefully at the objects of your worship, I found among them an altar with the inscription, 'To an unknown God.' What therefore you worship is unknown, this I proclaim to you: the God who made the world and everything in it, he who is Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in shrines made by human hands, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mortals life and breath and all things. From one ancestor, he made all nations to inhabit the whole earth, and he allotted the times of their existence and the boundaries of the places where they would live, so that they would search for God and perhaps grope for him and find him, though indeed he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your own poets have said, 'For we too are God's offspring.' Since we are God's offspring, we ought not to think that the deity is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of mortals. What God has overlooked, the times of human ignorance, now God commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will have the world judged in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. And of this he has given assurance of all, by raising him from the dead." If the Apostle Paul is correct, everybody is religious.
There is a hunger in each of our souls that wish to be satisfied. There is something out there that we dedicate our time and money. There is something greater than ourselves that we will bow down before.
Nowhere is this spoken so clearly as the story we heard from Acts chapter 17. The Apostle Paul speaks to the people of Athens and says, "I perceive you folks are very religious."
Now just imagine the awe that Paul must have been in. He was in the crown jewel of the Mediterranean empires, Athens. It was a very big city with incredible monuments. It was the home of Socrates and Plato. It was teeming with more energy than a college town. The city was named for Athena, goddess of wisdom, skill, and warfare. In Paul's day, the Romans called her Minerva, but the Greeks still lived there, and they weren't about to change her name. The center of Athens was the Parthenon, a temple dedicated to Athena. Now, we've all seen pictures in social studies class, but I can only imagine how beautiful it really was.
So get the picture. Here's the Apostle Paul in the city of Athens. He's on the run because he was always on the run. He had to sneak out of Thessalonica after dark. Friends got him as far as Berea, but the word then leaked out to his enemies. So he hopped aboard a boat and was dumped onto the shore next to Athens. He's waiting there for Silas and Timothy to catch up to him. My goodness, wouldn't we all want to be dropped off at Athens?
But Paul is a Jew, and when daylight comes, he walks down the street and sees all the shrines. He sees the statue of the god of war and thinks about peace. He sees the statue of Bacchus, the god of hangovers, and thinks only of temperance. He passes Hermes, messenger of Mount Olympus, who doubled as the god of commerce, and he could only think of how much money is wasted on all these statues. He passes by the goddess of fertility. She had a lot of names, but Paul thinks of only not having a girlfriend. Here he is, a Jew wandering up and down the sights of Idolatry Avenue. He sees all kinds of things he never dreamed existed. Because Jews don't go in for a lot of gods, their Bible says their God is a jealous God. There's only one God in whom we live and move and have our being.
So what is he to do? What are any of us to do when we have people on our streets who believe very different things from ourselves?
Well, Paul finds a few other Jews to talk about it. He begins with a support system of people who see the world the same way. And then he goes out and starts talking about it to everyone he meets. He raises a lot of questions.
What about these idols? How can you worship a breathless statue? Don't you know there's only one God and he raised Jesus from the dead? And pretty soon he develops a reputation with all the smart people in town. It's not a good reputation. In Eugene Peterson's translation of this text, they call him an airhead. In Greek, the term is technically seed picker, like a crow picking up a seed here and a seed there. They claim there's nothing consistent, he's just pecking away at ideas. He talks about anastasis, the Greek word for resurrection, and they think that's the name of some new deity they don't even have a shrine to yet.
So, with uncharacteristic reserve, he speaks to them in the Areopagus. The Areopagus was a shopping mall for ideas. If you had a new idea in Athens, you went to the Areopagus, and you made your case. Then everybody debated it with you. And rather than blow them out of the water and call them a bunch of stupid statue worshippers, Paul shows remarkable patience.
Listen, he says, as I walk up and down your streets, I see you are spiritual people, and all the spiritual people begin to smile. In fact, he says, I see you are a deeply spiritual people. You take your religion seriously. If anybody has a favorite god or favorite goddess, you put up a shrine to honor that one, and you're so careful about this, you don't want to take any chances and leave one out. So you put up a statue and you call it to the God we don't even know yet. Because heaven forbid there's a God out there you don't know about.
People of Athens, today is your lucky day. I'm here to tell you about the one God you do not know. This is the God who made us. This is the God we're seeking. And when we build all of our statues and make sense out of the world, this is really the God we have to deal with. He is the God above all other gods. All of us are really looking for him.
So I start thinking about some of the people that I've buried over the years. Loved ones will say, well, you know, Uncle Henry wasn't very religious, but he sure was spiritual and reverent. He wasn't a Presbyterian, but if he was, he certainly would have gone to your church. Maybe so. Uncle Henry tried to understand the world. He probably had some things that he loved to do and some people he trusted. I'm sure there were institutions he depended upon. The question to ask is whether or not all the other allegiances in our lives can measure up to the God who makes us and loves us.
The purpose of the church is to point to that God, to learn to love and worship that God, and to tell the world the truth about the one God, in whom all of us live and move and have our being.
And there are a lot of Bible texts that declare that we are inherently spiritual. To be a human being is to have the capacity for some kind of devotion, some attention. From the time we're born, we spend our time, our days, reaching for something. We devote incredible energy and time to worshiping something or somebody. And the honest truth is we end up worshiping something far less than God. It's nearly 20 years ago, but I remember it like it was yesterday. I took my older daughter to a worship service on the top of Montage Mountain. There were lights and videos, pounding drums and joyful music. Over here, there were kiosks where you could even purchase religious clothing, some of it much larger than the baptismal gown. At Katie's insistence, we bought a worship bulletin for $20. I tell you, I was really impressed. They put together an entire worship service that saturated the senses and moved our souls. It got us moving our feet. And as we stood on our chairs and listened to the music of Britney Spears, I looked around and said, "People of Montage, I can tell you are deeply religious in every way."
By now, most of us have figured out that there's more to life than what the star-making machinery does to people. The challenge in our age, in every age, is getting the story straight and pointing people to God who made us, whom we might not know.
And there's a lot of talk these days about how do we create new life in the churches and the religious communities. In my opinion, we'll never get very far until we can speak a clear and compelling word about the God we know in Jesus Christ. We have to repeatedly make the first-hand case, not a second-hand or observer case, but first-hand, as to why God is more life-giving and more loving than all the other gods out there. In that line I like from the Native Americans, is your church built on sacred soil? If so, we will come.
It's a continuing challenge. We live among people who are inherently religious. I have some idolaters as neighbors. They're very nice people, never make much trouble. Some of them have spent a lot of money on statues in their flower gardens. When I think of the places where they put their energy and devotion, I'm sad to think how much of it doesn't really provide any satisfaction.
And when I go up and down my street, I begin to think of the words of one of my mentors. Very early on, he was a pastor who had survived from the parish for many years, and I wanted to know, how do you do it? He said, "I had to decide really early that there's more to life than having kids with good teeth and a case of Michelob on the back porch. And every week I have to stand up and tell people that's the truth."
In a world of competing allegiances, maybe what I need to do is take a cue from the Apostle Paul. As he stands up in Athens, Paul announces that all of us belong to a search party. We search for meaning and purpose in the world. God knows what people often settle for, whatever they find. But sooner or later, we have to talk about the God who raised Jesus from the dead, and we have to decide if we can bet our lives on that kind of God. All of us have to decide, and that's the kind of decision I put before you today.
Jesus said, "I am the bread of life." I don't know anybody who has ever eaten from his table and stayed hungry.
Taste and see.